Standing on the rail of the coffee bar in the main hall of Jan Smuts Airport, I had a good view of the entrance to the international terminal. Ah, damn it, I swore. What is it? Sal asked anxiously. BYM, a whole platoon of them. What are BYM? Bright young men, Stuyvesant executives. There, see the four of them beside the bank counter? How do you know they're Stuyvesant men? She asked. Haircuts, short back and sides, uniforms, dark cashmere suits and plain ties. Expressions tense and ulcer-ridden but poised to blossom as the big man appears. And then I added in an unaccustomed fit of honesty. Besides, I recognize two of them. Accountants. Friends of mine. Have to prize money out of them every time I want a roll of toilet paper for the Institute.
Is that him? Asked Sally, and pointed.
Yes. Yes, I said, that's him. Lorenz Stuyvesant came out of the doors of the international terminal, the first of the Zurich flight through customs and immigration, the airport public relations officer trotting to keep pace with him. Two other BYM a pace behind him on either side, probably a third taking care of his luggage. The four waiting men broke into smiles that seemed to light the hall and hurried forward in order of seniority for a brief hand clasp and then fell into formation around Lorin. Two of them running interference ahead of him, the others closing in at either hand. The public relations officer fell back, bewildered, to the tail of the field, and Anglo-Stuyvesant drove across the crowded floor like an advancing panzer division. In their midst, Lorin stood out by a golden curly head, his sun-bronzed features grim in contrast to the artificial smiles around him. Come on! I caught Sally's hand and dove into the crowd. I'm good at this. I go in at the level of their legs, and the pressure from this unexpected level cleaves them open like the waters of the Red Sea. Sally ran through behind me like the Israelites. We intercepted Anglo-Stuyvesant at the glass exit doors, and I dropped Sally's hand to crack the inner circle. I broke through at the first attempt, and Lorin nearly tripped over me. Ben! I saw immediately how tired he was. Pale beneath the girl's skin, purply smudges under the eyes. But a warm smile cleared the fatigue for a moment. I'm sorry. I should have warned you not to come. Something's come up. I'm on my way to a meeting now. He saw the expression on my face and clasped my shoulder quickly. No. Don't jump to conclusions. It's still on. Be at the airfield at 5 o'clock tomorrow morning. I'll meet you there. I must go now. I'm sorry. We shook hands quickly. All the way, partner? He asked. All the way, I agreed, grinning at the schoolboy inanity. And then they swept on by and disappeared through the glass doors. We were halfway back to Johannesburg before Sally spoke. Did you ask him about me? Is it fixed? There wasn't time, Sal. You saw that. He was so rushed. Neither of us spoke again until I turned into the grounds of the Institute and parked the Mercedes beside her little red Alpha in the empty car park. Would you like a cup of coffee? I asked. It's late.
It isn't.
You won't sleep anyway, not tonight. We could have a game of chess. All right. I let us in at the front door, and we went through the public rooms, crowded with glass cases and wax figures, to the private staircase that led to my office and flat. Sal lit the fire and set out the chessmen while I made coffee. When I came back from the kitchen, she was sitting cross-legged on a tooled leather pouf, brooding over the ivory and ebony chessboard. I caught my breath at the fresh dimension of her loveliness that the light and setting presented to me. She wore a patchwork poncho, as brilliantly coloured as the oriental carpet strewn on the floor about her, and the gentle side-lighting glowed on the soft, sun-touched olive of her skin. Watching her, I thought my heart might burst. She looked up with those big, soft eyes. "Come," she said, "let's play." If I can weather the storm of her first lightning, volatile attacks, then I can smother and wear her down with pawn play and superior development. She calls it the creeping death. At last she toppled her queen with a little groan of exasperation and stood up to pace restlessly about the room, hugging her own shoulders under the vivid poncho. I sipped coffee and watched her with covert pleasure, until suddenly she swirled and faced me with long legs astride and clenched fists on her hips, her elbows tenting the poncho around her. "I hate the bastard," she said in a tight, strangled voice. "Big, arrogant godman. I knew the type as soon as I saw him. Why, in the name of all that's holy, does he have to come with us? If we make any significant discovery, you can guess who'll hog all the glory." I knew immediately she was talking of Lauren, and I was startled by the acid and gall in her tone. Later, I would remember it and know the reason. But now I was stunned and then angry. "What on earth are you talking about?" I demanded. "The face, the walk, the flock of idolaters, the condescending air with which he dispenses favours, the immense overpowering conceit of the man. Sally, the casual, unthinking cruelty of his presumption." "Stop it, Sally." I was on my feet now. "Did you see those poor little men of his shaking with fright?" "Sally, you'll not talk of him like that. Not in front of me." "Did you see yourself, one of the gentlest, kindest, most decent men I've ever known, and one of the finest brains I've ever been privileged to work with, did you see yourself scampering and tail-wagging? God, you were rolling on your back at his feet, offering your belly to be tickled." She was almost hysterical now, crying, tears of anger running down her face, shaking, white-faced. "I hated you and him. I hated you both. He was demeaning you, making you cheap and..." I couldn't answer her. I stood stricken and numb, and her temper changed. She lifted her hand and pressed it to her mouth. We stared at each other. "I must be mad," she half whispered. "Why did I say those things? Ben, oh, Ben, I'm sorry. So very sorry." And she came and knelt before me. Her arms went around my body and she hugged me to her. I stood like a statue. I was cold with fear, dread of what was to come. For although this was what I'd long prayed for, yet it had come so suddenly, without a moment's warning, and now I'd been thrust far beyond the point of no return into unknown territory. Sally lifted her head, still clinging to me, and looked up into my face. "Forgive me, please." I kissed her, and her mouth was warm and salty with tears. Her lips opened under mine, and my fear was gone. "Make love to me, Ben, please." She knew instinctively that I must be led. She took me to the couch. "The lights," I whispered harshly. "Please switch off the lights."
"If that's what you want."
"Please, Sally."
"I will," she said. "I know, my darling." And she switched off the lights. Twice in the darkness she cried out, "Oh, please, Ben, you're so strong. You're killing me. Your arms are... And then, not long after, she screamed, an incoherent cry without form or meaning, and my own hoarse cry blended with it. And then there was only the ragged sound of our breathing in the darkness. I felt as though my mind had broken free from my body and floated in warmth and darkness. For the first time in my life, I was completely at rest, contented and secure. There seemed to be so many first times with this woman. When at last Sally spoke, her voice came as a small shock. "Will you sing for me, Ben?" And she switched on the lights on the table beside the couch. We blinked at each other, owl-eyed in the muted glow. Her face was flushed rosily, and her hair a dark, unruly tumble. "Yes, yes," I said. "I want to sing." I went through into my dressing room and took the guitar from the cupboard, and as I closed the door, there was my reflection in the full-length mirror. I looked with full attention, for a stranger stood before me. The coarse black hair framed a square face with dark eyes and girlishly long lashes, a heavy simian jaw, and a long pale forehead. The stranger was smiling at me, half shy and half proud. I glanced down the strange telescoped body over which I'd agonized since childhood. The legs and arms were overdeveloped, thick and knotted with slabs of muscle, the limbs of a giant. Instinctively, I glanced at the bodybuilder's weights in the corner of the room, and then back to the mirror. I was perfect round the edges, but in the center was this squat, humped, toad-like torso, covered in a shaggy pelt of curly black hair. I looked at that remarkable body, and again, for the first time in my life, I didn't hate it. I went back to where Sally still lay on the soft monkey-skin karos that covered the couch. I hopped up and squatted cross-legged beside her, with the guitar in my lap. "Sing sad, please, Ben," she whispered. "But I'm happy, Sal." "Sing a sad song. One of your own sad ones," she insisted. And as I picked out the first notes, she closed her eyes. I was grateful, for I'd never had a woman's body to gloat over. I leaned forward, and as I touched the singing strains, I caressed the long, smooth length of her with my eyes, the pale planes and rounds and secret shadows, flesh that had cradled mine. How I loved it! I sang. In the lonely desert of my soul, the nights are long, and no other traveller journeys there. O'er the lonely oceans of my mind, the winds blow strong. And in a short while, a tear squeezed out between her closed lids. For there is a magic in my voice, which can call up tears or laughter. I sang until my throat was rough and my picking finger tender. Then I laid the guitar aside and went on looking at her. Without opening her eyes, she turned her head slightly towards me. "Tell me about you and Lauren Stuyvesant," she said. "I'd like to understand about that." The question took me by surprise, and I was silent for a moment. She opened her eyes. "I'm sorry, Ben. You don't have to." "No, no," I answered quickly. "I'd like to talk about it. You see, I think you were wrong about him. I don't think you can apply ordinary standards to them, you know, the Stuyvesants. Lauren and his father, when he was alive, that is. My own father worked for them. He died of a broken heart a year after my mother. Mr. Stuyvesant had heard of my academic record, and of course my father had been a loyal employee. There are a few of us, these Stuyvesant orphans. We've nothing but the best. I went to Michael House, the same school as Lauren. A Jew at a church school, and a cripple at that. You can imagine how it was. Small boys are such utterly merciless little monsters. Lauren dragged me out of the urinal where four of them were trying to drown me. He beat the daylights out of them, and after that I was his charge. I have been ever since. He finances this institute, every penny of it. At first it was something just for me. but little by little he has become more and more involved. It's his hobby and my life. You'll be surprised how knowledgeable he is. He loves this land, just as you and I do. He's caught up in its history and future, more than you or I will ever be. I broke off, for she was staring at me in a way that seemed to pierce my soul. You love him, Ben, don't you? I blushed then and dropped my eyes. How do you mean that? Oh, for God's sake, Ben, she interrupted impatiently. I don't mean queer. You just proved the opposite. But I mean love in the biblical sense. He has been father, protector, benefactor and friend to me, the only friend I've ever had. Yes, yes, you could say I love him. She reached up and touched my cheek. I'll try to like him, for your sake. It was still dark when we drove in through the gates of Grand Central Airport. Sal was huddled into her coat, silent and withdrawn. I was light-headed and brittle-feeling from a night of love and talk without sleep. There were floodlights picking out the private Stuyvesant hangar at the east end of the runway, and as we approached, I saw Lorenz Ferrari parked in his reserved bay, and beside it another half-dozen late model saloons gleaming in the floods. Oh, God, I groaned. He's got the whole team with him. I parked beside the Ferrari, and Sal and I began unloading our equipment from the boot. She picked up her easel and slung it over her shoulder, and then, with a huge folder of parchment in one hand and a box of paints in the other, she ducked through the wicket gate into the hangar. I should have gone with her, of course, but I was so absorbed in checking my luggage that it was 3 or 4 minutes before I followed her. By then it was too late. As I stepped through the low aperture into the brightly lit hangar, my stomach churned with alarm. The gleaming, shark-like silhouette of the Lear jet formed a backdrop for a tension-charged tableau. 7 of Loren's bright young men, clad in the regulation casual garb, smartly cut safari suits and fleece-lined fur car coats, stood in a discreet circle about the two protagonists. Loren Stuyvesant very rarely loses his temper, and when he does, it is only after severe and prolonged provocation. However, in less than 2 minutes, Sally Benatar had managed to achieve what many experts before her had never accomplished. Loren was in a towering, shaking, tight-lipped rage, which had his 7th BYM awed and slack-mouthed. Sally had dropped her load of equipment on the concrete floor and was standing with clenched fists on her hips and bright explosions of color burning in her cheeks, trading Loren glare for glare. Dr. Kazin told me I could come. I don't care if the goddamn King of Bloody England told you you could come. I'm telling you that the plane is full, and that I've no intention of dragging a female with me on the first break I've had in 6 months. I didn't realize it was a pleasure jaunt. Will somebody throw this bitch out of here? Shouted Loren. And the BYM roused themselves and made a tentative advance. Sally picked up the heavy wooden easel and held it in both hands. The advance petered out. I scuttled into the void and grabbed Lorin's arm. Please, Lo, can we talk? I almost dragged him into the flight office, although I thought I detected a twinge of relief from Lorin as I rescued him. Look, I'm terribly sorry about this, Lo. I didn't have a chance to explain. 5 minutes later, Loren strode out of the office, and without a glance at either Sal or the frozen group of BYM, climbed into the jet, and a moment later his head appeared beside that of the pilot in the window of the cockpit as he adjusted his earphones. I went to the junior BYM and gave him the word of the law.
Mr. Stervison's asked me to tell you to arrange a charter to Gaborone's for yourself. And then I turned to the others. I wonder if you could give us a hand with the luggage.
While a gang of the most highly paid stevedores in Africa carried in Sally's luggage, she preened with shameless triumph. I managed to whisper a harsh warning.
Back seat, I snapped, and try and make yourself invisible. You will never know how close that was. Not only did you nearly miss the trip, but you almost talked yourself out of a job.